This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we take a trip back in time and hear stories from our greatest generation. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want their stories to be preserved so we don't forget what kind of price has been paid for our freedom. And of course, along the way, as we visit with veterans, no matter how big or how small their hometowns might be, we believe that what they did should be celebrated, and we sure learn quite a bit along the way. We're going to do that today with Melvin Cobb, 92 years old, of Fresno, California. Originally from the Richmond, Virginia area, though, you might detect still a little bit of a southern accent in this 92-year-old's voice. What was life growing up out there in the woods of Virginia?
You didn't have anything, and you once wouldn't have an idea of wanting anything like that, because when I was a kid, I'd like to have a bicycle or a tricycle or stuff like that because other kids had it. Well, it wasn't a thing like that because we had a big farm. We had to work all the time. And my dad, he couldn't read or write, and he raised 9 kids, and everything was nothing but work. He did a lot of fishing, and I did a lot of fishing with him, and did a lot of hunting, and did a hunting in daytime. We hunted nighttime, took coons, and anything that we do. And then it was just once was nil. We had whatever we wanted. I mean, we wanted wild turkey for Thanksgiving. We had wild turkey for Thanksgiving.
And when you talk about hunting, you're not talking about for sport. This is to eat whatever you were killing for subsistence. When you got 9 kids, you got a lot of mouths to feed.
Oh, yeah. We raised our own, had our own cows, had our own milk, made our own butter, and we had plenty of deer to eat. We had plenty of duck, and we had geese, and we had a lot of quail, so our wants was nil. We just had, you know, we had a gun, and that's what we used, and that's what we ate. And we killed our own hogs every year. We always had about 3 of those that we'd kill every year in November, I think, and take it and put it in a shed or whatever it was we had there, and kept it for winter months. So we had plenty of ham and sausage and whatever we wanted, we had.
And you didn't know anything different. I think about the old fable of the country mouse and the city mouse. Being a country boy, did you have any desire to see what else was out there and what this big world was all about?
Well, no, because it wasn't anything, you know. The only thing that I would do, like, we had a big 100-acre pond in back of our house that some doctors and lawyers owned in Richmond, and I used to go down there, and they'd stop by my house and pick me up and take me down, and I would paddle them when they were fishing, but it was no boats. It was just a paddle. They didn't use any motors or anything like that.
So you did that to earn some extra change? You paddled the boat while they fished? So you did that to earn some extra change? You paddled the boat while they fished?
I paddled the boat while they fished, and I think, I paddled most afternoon, and I got 25 cents. So from my house to West Point, which was a little town, you could go to the show and get an ice cream cone and Coke for 25 cents. But that was 7 miles I had to walk every day if I wanted to.
How far did you have to walk for school?
Oh, I don't know, maybe a couple of miles, what little bit I did go to school. And I think later on in the years, I think we had school buses, but they didn't come around to the country. They just come out on the highway. So you'd have to walk to the highway to get on the bus at a certain time.
Looking back, thinking about having so many siblings, being in a big family, do you think that had some benefit for you? Did that do something for you that you appreciate now?
Well, yes, because my dad he couldn't read or write, so he just made his living out of the rivers and out of the woods. But your wants was nil. I never had a bicycle or a tricycle. I made my own slingshots and went down in the woods and got the wood to do it with, and that's the way it was. And Sunday, that was Sunday. My dad wouldn't let us do nothing on Sundays. And everything on Sunday was shut down. We didn't go fishing. We didn't go hunting. We never did anything like that. That was his motto and his way of saying that's the way of life.
Yeah, it's that idea of a Sabbath is pretty lost on us these days in this culture. A lot of people can't say, like you can, what you remember about December 7th, 1941. I like to ask every veteran about the day that Pearl Harbor was bombed. Did you find out right away, or did it take a while for news to spread out there to the woods?
No, they just sent me a card to be at a such and such a place at a certain day.
Oh, you're talking about when you were drafted, but yeah. did you hear about Pearl Harbor when it happened, that America had been bombed?
I've been there a number of times, but we had no way of finding out. I don't think it was any papers bringing to me, because we just didn't live too far back in the woods.
You mentioned to me earlier, before we were on the radio here, that you didn't think they'd draft you because you didn't think they'd find you way back there in the woods. How big of an exaggeration is that, or is that the truth?
Well, that's the truth.
How many boys from your family ended up serving in the war?
I was the only one.
So when you got that draft notice in 1942, what was your reaction to it? What did it mean to you?
It meant that I had to go to the service. There wasn't no such thing that you think you're going to go, you went. Or you wish you had gone if you didn't. But no, it was just something that happens, and that was a way of life for me. None of my other brothers went at that time, but because they all had jobs, and I think working for the government or something might have had something to do with keeping them out of there. But I was the youngest one out of the four.
And I would have thought, you know, just listening to you describe your childhood and all the different critters that you shot with a gun, that the Army would put that to use and put you in the infantry or something like that, where your rifle eye could do some good. Did you expect to go in the infantry? How is it that you ended up an aviation engineer?
Well, I had been taking my basic training, and this is where I took my basic training out here at Hammer Field. And they had you'd have a bunch of questions to ask that they would ask you, and you'd write down as to what you want to be or where you want to go. What I put down, I guess, is that's where they sent me, you know, to be aviation engineers.
They sent you here to Fresno. In fact, we're pretty close. Your home is not too far from Hammer Field, as it was then in 1942, what is now the Fresno Yosemite International Airport. What was Hammer Field like back then?
We had thousands of GIs here. They even had big two-story buildings where they have a top and a bottom. I think I got here just before Thanksgiving, and then I think I left later in March or April. They shipped me back east to New York, and that's where I went overseas.
Being around that many people, was that an adjustment for you, having grown up with such a rural existence?
Well, it was something. I don't know whether you call it excitement or not, but you know, we was always going out shooting guns, getting practice, and taking exercise. That was every morning. You never miss. Then if you wanted to take our guns out and shoot them, we'd put all our bunks up in one side, and we'd get up if it was raining. Then we'd get out there on the floor and do practice on the floor with our guns and stuff.
And some people might be putting two and two together here as they listen to you. They say, well, he's from Virginia. It was the military that sent him to Fresno, to Hammer Field, to train to be an aviation engineer. But yet he still lives in Fresno. Something must have happened there. I guess it's a good thing that you got sent to Hammer Field, because otherwise you never would have met your wife. Tell me about that.
Well, she belonged to a sorority-like thing, and they could invite GIs. They'd have their own place to go. They would go dancing, so they would take us to the dances. Like we had one big ballroom there in Fresno, and I think it's still there.
Was that the Rainbow Ballroom?
Rainbow Ballroom, and we'd go there and dance, and then we had friends. So we used to go there. If we didn't go there, we'd go someplace else where we could just dance. It was just an ongoing good thing for, you know, being here and getting training. And that was the only way we got to do something, would be up to the girls that you know, would take us different places to go dancing at night times. We was out here at Hammer Field, and we were invited to invite some girls for Thanksgiving. But anyway, I invited her over to Hammer Field to have dinner with me and other kids there.
You wouldn't be here that long, because Uncle Sam needed you to move on to the East Coast. But when you left here, did you have a feeling you were going to see her again? Did you say anything about that?
Well, you know, I figured, well, this is it, you know, because she was really a wonderful, wonderful girl. She wrote to me every day. while I was overseas, and I never missed a day from not getting a letter from her. Sometimes it'd be 2 or 3, 4 days a week before they would catch up with us, because we were going all the time.
Between the time you said goodbye to her in Fresno and the time you saw her again, I know you went through quite a bit. What kind of training did you receive to be an aviation engineer? What were the things that you had to know how to do?
It just was a laboring thing, I would say. We built that big runway in England, two of them. One was 1.5 miles and 1.75 miles, and 175 feet. And all it was all concrete, and they had what they call hard stands. When the pilots were coming off of a mission, they could have room enough for pull off so the other one could go and pull off, you know. But it's all concrete, and it's there today.
That sounds like a pretty big job. What did you have to specifically do yourself?
Well, we just have to have trucks come along, and I have to throw up 100-pound or 200-pound sacks of concrete. They load the truck up with so much dirt, sand, and you pull that on, and the truck would take off and get it wet and take it out onto the runway. And they had what they call like a streeter. It was made like railroad tires. You'd put that down and it would be so wide. And then that thing would work automatic. You'd get on those two things and go forward and you'd drive it. And that would smooth the concrete out as it went along. We did that for 12 months and was somebody there before we got there.
So you spent 12 months in England. How much of a taste of the war did you get while you were in England? Were you aware of what was happening? Were there things you saw that you'd never seen before that opened your eyes a little bit?
Well, just having Germans flying over every night. There never was a night that we didn't get some Germans flying over bombing England. It was that way, but you never had any night lights any time. In London, we didn't live right in London, but with no lights anywhere in London when they'd come over. And they had these here flares, like, they light up. And the way they could find out where they wanted to bomb, they'd come over and drop those flares, and wherever those flares come down, that's where they would bomb, do their bombing. And they really tore it up.
What was it like to see the effects of the bombing and to see the devastation that could wreak?
Well, it was just, you know, places that you could go and see where where the bombs dropped and where they tore it up. It was just unreal to know that they could do stuff like that.
And as you're spending all this time in England, were you aware that eventually you guys would be crossing the channel?
No, not at that time. No. I guess we got our words through company or whoever it was that we had to get ready to go to build runways for all the fighter planes, because we were right behind the infantry most of the time, because every time they would go and clear a way for us and give us the okay when to go in and get out and get going.
I want to hear about what you saw when you came ashore in France, but first we need to step away for a moment. When we come back, 92-year-old Mel Cobb takes us back to Utah Beach in June of 1944. Hometown Heroes will continue right after this. Our World War II veterans deserve a chance to see their memorial in Washington, D.C., and you can help send them there simply by renting a car. Between now and the end of October, visit any Enterprise Rent-A-Car location from Bakersfield in the south to Tulare, Visalia, Hanford, Selma, Fresno, Madera, Merced, all the way north to Sacramento. Tell them you heard this ad on Hometown Heroes, and Enterprise will donate 10% of your rental to Central Valley Honor Flight. Restrictions may apply. I'm sure you're familiar with Enterprise, but do you know why the largest car rental company in the U.S. is called Enterprise? The company's founder, Jack Taylor, was a decorated F-6F Hellcat pilot in World War II, flying off the deck of the Big E, the aircraft carrier USS Enterprise. Maybe I should get him on the show sometime and he can tell us how he earned the Distinguished Flying Cross. In the meantime, choose Enterprise for your next rental. Tell him you heard this advertisement on Hometown Heroes, and you'll be helping to send our World War II veterans on one more tour with honor. They say a picture is worth 1,000 words, but when it comes to making my mouth water, I don't need 1,000 words, just 2 of them. Mongolian beef. Okay, 2 more. Ming's restaurant. And I guess if you want to know where to find it, I should give you 2 more. Las Banas. That's where I grew up. And I'm guessing Las Banas is somewhere you pass through every now and then. And if you drop in for the Mongolian beef, you might start calling it what I have for years. My favorite place to eat, period.
He may not look old enough for this to be true, but the owner, Paul Cito, has been working his magic in the kitchen there for 45 years now. It's all delicious. If you're a garlic fan, try the Baja shrimp and thank me later. But the Mongolian beef is absolutely unmatched. The flavor, incredible. The texture, tremendous. I can't do it justice with words. You just got to go taste it. One word of caution. Do not go on Monday because Ming's is closed on Mondays. So pick another day, tell them I sent you, and let me know if your taste buds enjoy it as much as mine do. That's Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in lovely Las Banas, California.